We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. It's been estimated by the Mexican government that over 28,000 people have died in drug-related violence in Mexico since the end of 2006, and more than 2,000 of those were police officers. This kind of violence is not particularly new, although it seems that it has been particularly bad over the last, say, 2.5 years. Our guest in this hour of Focus, LA Times reporter Sam Quiñones, has traveled through most of the country. He's written 2 books about Mexico. He says the country is fighting for its life, but most Americans have no idea what's happening right next door. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll try to review some current developments in Mexico, talk about what they mean for the United States. And our guest is indeed Sam Quiñones. He now works for the LA Times as a journalist. He's worked also for the Orange County Register and the Tacoma News Tribune, has spent a lot of time traveling in Mexico and writing about Mexico, and in fact has authored 2 books, 2 nonfiction books. His first, titled True Tales from Another Mexico, that was published in 2001. The other is Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration. That was published in 2007. So his books are out there if you'd like to take a look at it. Also, if you'd like to learn more about him and his writing, you can look at his website, which is samquiñones.com, and his last name is spelled Quiñones. I'm sure you can find it without any trouble. And also here in this part of the show, we'd welcome questions. Now, we do hope that people will make them questions and keep them brief, that way that we'll get in as many callers as possible. But people who are listening certainly can get into the conversation. 333-9455 is the number. That's for Champaign Urbana, folks. That's our local number. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we have email, so you can send your comments that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Mr. Quiñones, hello.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. Again, I much appreciate it. I mentioned this this number that comes from the Mexican government relatively recent, and now you read it in all the stories you read about Mexico, 28,000. And apparently there are some people think that if the present trend continues, by the end of the current term of the current president, Felipe Calderon, we could be talking about 75,000. So that's like in 2012. So it's he's got a couple of years to go. I guess that I come back to this question, that why is it that it seems that particularly, say, over the last couple of years, things have gotten so much worse?
Well, I'm actually not certain that that's actually the case. Yes, things have gotten very bad. I would say it goes back a few more years than that, though. I would say that all of this, first of all, a little bit of history. This stuff really began to kick off before Felipe Calderon took office. It's important to note that because people seem to think that it starts exactly with him calling in the army, and that is really not true at all. What happened was the cartels began to war among themselves, beginning in late 04 through 05 through 06, and in certain areas, and principally the border with Texas, Reynosa, Matamoros, Nuevo Laredo in particular was awfully ferocious fighting there. They would pit police force against police force. One officers from one cartel connected to one cartel would fight against officers connected to another. One police chief lasted, 6 hours in office. All of that was going on really as a fight between cartels in 04, 05, and 06. Felipe Calderon takes office at the end in December 1st of 06. Now, it's important to understand that because that is an important component of everything that comes later, the wars between or among the different cartels. Felipe Calderon comes to office with this already going on at the end of 06. He really has no recourse. Mexico has none of the very strong, very well-trained, very well-paid local police forces, regional task forces that we enjoy in the United States. It's a crucial, crucial thing to understand that we have this kind of regional and local approach to law enforcement that is very strong, very well trained. Most law enforcement agencies are really well, very, very competent in this country. And they are really the first bulwark against any kind of drug trafficking or any kind of like what really this is, which is simply criminal activity. Mexico, that doesn't exist. He doesn't have any of that. And so he has only one weapon in this fight that he has to now undertake as he takes office, and that is the Mexican army. So the Mexican army begins to hit these hot spots that these cartels have opened up in different parts of the country, warring among themselves. First it was the border with Texas, then it switches over to the Pacific coast. Always these battlegrounds are either with places where drugs enter the United Mexico, or they leave Mexico for the United States. So the Texas border, the Pacific coast, where the cocaine and sometimes even the chemicals to make methamphetamine come into Mexico. These are the areas where at least at first these battles are going on among the different cartels. He then has to take action with the only weapon, as I said, that he has available to him, and this is the Mexican army. The Mexican army is not a police force. It's not trained as such, but it's all he's got. And so he has deployed the Mexican soldiers in different places across the country and sometimes redeployed them when other places got hot after one area kind of calmed down. Lately, I would say what has anyway, for the last 4 years, you've just seen the wars among the cartels enhanced by the war between the cartels and the army. Mm-hmm. And so the death toll has kind of just increased incessantly, it seems like. Lately, I would say what has really been scary is how it has spread to the political sphere of Mexico. No great love for Mexican politicians here, but it's not a healthy thing at all when you have politicians being gunned down or kidnapped. And that's what's happened in the last couple of months, certainly. Last couple of weeks, there were murders of mayors in the towns of Hidalgo, Tamaulipas, and then another town, Santiago, Nuevo León. You've had the former mayor of Tampico, a big businessman as well, kidnapped recently. And the main thing, which was the kidnapping of a man by the name, known affectionately to Mexicans as Jefe Diego Fernandez de Ceballos. He was once a presidential candidate in 1994, and then he was kind of the head of the center right political party that is Felipe Calderón's party called the PAN. Hmm. He was kidnapped, and I can't remember exactly the day. I want to say July. He's been kidnapped since then, and I don't, you know, it's kind of not too optimistic about that case. So. You've got a spreading in a sense. You've also got a particularly heinous case in the state of Tamaulipas as well, which was the murder, a massacre, the mowing down apparently of 72 immigrants coming from other countries, Brazil, Ecuador, Honduras, I believe some other countries there, through Mexico to the United States. And 72 of these folks were gunned down in a case that really isn't all that clear. In fact, the man who was investigating the case for the government was also gunned down I think it was last week. So you've got this kind of these very ominous signs, I think, that are the death toll is certainly ominous and no doubt about it. But there's some other things going on as well that make me kind of a little queasy, I would say.
Yeah. Well, just President Calderon, when he came into office, he seemed to make it a priority to go after the cartels and that right. What they decided to do particularly was to target the people at the very top. And some of those people have been killed and they have been arrested. I think also some people have said that one maybe unforeseen or unintended, the result is in these organizations, if you take out the top guys, then everybody else is going to be fighting for control, which is going to lead to increased violence.
Yeah, let me say the yes and no on that. That's a really good point, and it often happens. In fact, you've seen this in other mafia wars. I think this happened in New York during the battle against the mafia there. From time to time, when they take out some big capo or what have you. And it's certainly true. I should say that along with the queasy feeling that I'm getting from some of the cases coming out of Mexico, I'm also getting some very, very optimistic, kind of an optimistic feeling for the first time. And that is because they are taking down some of these major capos. And one guy was Ignacio Coronel, who was kind of number three in the Sinaloa cartel. He is now dead, killed a couple months ago during the summer. They just captured a very famous narco who had been in kind of in different cartels, and his loyalties shifted as the terrain shifted. Edgar Valdez, known to all as La Barbie, because he's got blonde hair, and therefore he somehow got nicknamed Barbie. Also in December, the death of Arturo Beltran Leyva, who was a major cartel leader. In Cuernavaca, in a gun battle there, all of these are very, very healthy signs that these guys are going down. Why? Because frequently, I believe that these guys rise because they are somehow talented individuals in what you need to be talented in as a drug cartel leader. And that is, first of all, of course, you have to be willing to kill at the drop of a hat. But that is not the only thing. You do have to have administrative capacity that not everybody possesses. You do have to have this ability to kind of organize and direct hardened criminals, drug addicts, farm boys, people who are very difficult to organize and direct. And so I'm not saying that their place will never be taken. There's a lot of people coming up from the bottom, Lord knows, and the talent pool is large. But it's not just so easy as to say, if you knock out one guy, you knock out, everybody else, his place will soon be taken, and there's no point. There's therefore the idea being that there's no point in taking out the big guy. I would say there's one very interesting a case of this that I saw here near Los Angeles in the city of Tijuana. I was speaking with a trafficker one time in jail, and he said, you know, we're talking about the Tijuana cartel that now is in tatters. It's not even a shadow of its former self. It was once the most fearsome cartel in all of Mexico in the 1990s, run by the brothers, the Arellano Felix brothers, the most bloodthirsty guys in their era ever. That was kind of seems almost a quaint era now, considering what's been going on lately. But whatever the case, they had a guy who ran Tijuana for them. His name was Ismael Higuera, now known as El Mayel to everybody. This guy was a master administrator. He was he also knew how to kill people at the drop of a hat for absolutely no reason sometimes. He knew who he was dealing with, which was a bunch of thugs and criminals and what have you. But he also managed to send tons and tons of drugs every year through the border, the most heavily guarded border in the world, I would say, certainly among the most heavily guarded borders in the world, using thugs and criminals and gang members and drug addicts. Once he got caught, I mean, this guy hired mining engineers to build tunnels underneath the border, the tunnels large enough so men could walk through standing up, you know, that kind of thing. He would have been the president of FedEx, you know, I mean, that's how talented this guy was, it sounds like. Once he was caught, which was in 2001, you can begin to trace the falling apart of this cartel to the point today where it still exists, but it's really not the major force that it once was, which is to say that in a lot of this fight, personalities, talents do matter. It's not just to say that one guy is replaceable with 100 different other guys. That may not always be the case.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Sam Quiñones, is a journalist and author. He works as a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, has spent a lot of time living in, traveling around, and writing about Mexico, has authored two nonfiction books about Mexico. And we're talking about contemporary Mexican politics and also the issue of violence connected with drugs. We have a caller here to talk with. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Also, you can send your questions and comments to will-talk@illinois.edu if you want to do it by email. We have a caller here in Belgium to talk with on our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I understand that the problem is directly related to our importation of drugs and our exportation of weapons into Mexico and the economic fugitives we have that come from South America and Central America mainly, I guess. I understand how they complicate the problem. But what I don't understand is drugs are very prevalent on our northern border, too. They import a lot of high-grade marijuana into the United States, a lot of heroin into the United States, but we don't have the same sort of problem to our immediately north border as we do to our south. Is there a reason for that?
Wow, that is such a good question. Yeah. I mean, in order to answer it, you kind of get into big discussions of Mexican history and politics and the political system that ruled Mexico for so long. But so it is kind of, and you can write an entire book based on answering the question of the last caller there. But let me say this as a way of trying to discuss this. In Mexico, the way the country was run by the party that ran the Mexico for 71 years until the year 2000 was to kind of use corruption and time at the public trough as a way of buying loyalties. So you had an entire country based on essentially the idea that every man has his price. It was a unique in a century of one party states. One of the most successful one-party states was one that had no ideology whatsoever. It was the party that ran Mexico. Its only ideology was self-preservation, and therefore corruption and payoffs and all that became really part of the political system, a way of buying people off. This is important when you understand the drug trade. To understand the drug trade, because beginning in the 70s and really taking hold in the early 80s, the government began to organize. Certain elements of the Mexican government saw that this was a particularly lucrative trade, the drug trade into the United States, and began to organize these traffickers. Remember, these traffickers are a bunch of hillbillies, illiterate guys from the mountains who the political class look upon as a bunch of yahoos, you know. And so they begin to organize certain elements of the Mexican government, who are already kind of criminally minded anyway, begin to organize the border. They divide up the U.S. border into essentially, just for these purposes today, about four areas. The Tijuana, L.A., the Sonora into Arizona, El Paso, Juarez, and then stretching down the Rio Grande, and then the Gulf part of Mexico, the very end leading into to the Gulf of Mexico, that border. Basically, the idea was that if you had control of that area, everybody else, if they wanted to get their dope through you, and there was a lot of freelance, independent traffickers and whatnot, had to pay you a toll. So these cartels form around the idea that they are also toll takers, and they kind of control that area. And in fact, as some of them have literally had, you know, teams of guys roaming the city. Tijuana was particularly true of this. They had the city broken up into sectors here, you know, to see if anybody going through your sector from south with southern plates, anything like that, we stop them. We say, what are you doing here? And they pay a tax. A lot of times guys would just come up and say, hey, we're trying to go through here. What can we pay you? I mean, it got to that point. So the government itself became part of the of trafficking, and really for a while there, it was really the world's greatest, largest drug trafficker, you could say. All of this also is overlaid on an idea that Mexico has never invested in its local authorities at all. local government, local police, local prisons, local schools, local everything have just been underfunded and are incredibly weak. All of the power kind of kept in Mexico City, in the central government of Mexico City. That system existed for many, many years and bred a whole bunch of corruption and also allowed these cartels to get enormous and very well funded and very well armed and pretty sophisticated in a lot of the weaponry and whatnot that they use. That system began to break down with the end of the PRI in 2000 and now has completely broken down. The government is no longer facilitating this, I don't believe. I mean, in the way it used to anyway. There may be certain people who are. But I mean, in the kind of organized way that it used to, and so now you have this breakdown in control. Now you have that's why these cartels are now battling among themselves ferociously, horribly. I mean, killing each other, beheadings, all this kind of stuff, and then you also have now the army on top of that. So you have this history to the southern border that you simply do not have in the northern border with Canada. You have very strong, my impression is from talking with Canadians and Canadian cops, that you have some very strong, very capable, very well-paid and motivated local cops up there. You have a very strong military presence and that kind of thing. I mean, they don't need to get to the military. They have the local cops. But there really is not that history of allowing these guys to grow and grow like a cancer, to grow and grow until they're almost unstoppable, which is what has happened to Mexico and what we're seeing the effects of right now.
Now, wouldn't this problem be solved or at least reduced if we just changed our drug laws and our gun laws?
Wow. Yeah, you know, maybe, yeah, maybe, I don't know. I mean, look, I'm a reporter, okay? I try not to get into once a reporter starts sounding off about, I have my own personal opinions that I don't think I'm going to divulge on this show. But once a reporter starts talking about his own personal opinions of what policy should be, then you get into some issues. I believe that listeners can draw their own conclusions, whatever those might be. Let me say one thing, and I'm not sure if I mentioned this last time I was on this show. I know that I've mentioned it a few times, and that's simply to state a fact. And that is that in Mexico, the traffickers have grown strong based on marijuana, illegal marijuana. That is we call marijuana the gateway drug here in the United States, but, you know, the drug that leads to use of other drugs, and that may very well be true. What I also know to be the truth, though, is that Mexican traffickers have almost all of them. It's a little different today, and I'll explain why in a minute, but basically almost all Mexican traffickers have gotten their start with marijuana. Why? Because it grows very easily in the mountains of Mexico. It's not a difficult drug to kind of assemble. You know, it's not like cocaine and packaging and all that stuff. It's also, you have it locally, of course, as I said. And then, you know, you can take it over in a couple of pounds, a couple of kilos at a time, and develop both your connections, your confidence, your abilities as a trafficker, and of course the big thing, your cash reserves. So you know, 2 pounds can lead to 6 pounds, 6 pounds can lead to 20, 20 can lead to 100, and by that time, you have the ability, the connections, and the know-how, and the confidence, I would say too, to be able to make other contacts, and that's when you get into smuggling things like cocaine, which you just cannot. You cannot just develop contacts for cocaine being just a Joe Blow small startup trafficker. You have to actually have done this for a while. You have to have accumulated some assets because the guys who are going to front you their cocaine want to know that there's something that they can take from you if you lose their cocaine. But at the foundation of all this is marijuana. And it continues to be, although other drugs are now also possible to make in Mexico, primarily methamphetamine. And marijuana has always been in demand. There's never these other drugs, methamphetamine, coke, heroin, have come and gone with in popularity. The cocaine is really kind of on the wane, crack cocaine most definitely. Methamphetamine is on the rise. Heroin certainly is on the rise nowadays in a lot of parts of the United States. But marijuana has always been just had a steady demand, so it's like kind of a reliable amount of revenue that these guys can always rely on, and so you have That's just, I'm not sure I want to get into all the questions of what we need to do as a country. Certainly, our guns are fueling all that. There's no doubt about that. They've found our guns in just numerous places all across Mexico. It's also true that these traffickers now have access to the international gun market abroad, given the money that they now have. But certainly our guns are down there.
We're at our midpoint here, and I have another call I want to get to, and let me again introduce the guest. We're talking with journalist author Sam Quiñones, who writes for the L.A. Times. He's spent in the past few years a lot of time in Mexico, traveling through Mexico, writing about it. He's the author of two nonfiction books, his first published in 2001, True Tales from Another Mexico, and then his second is Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration, that was published in 2007. If you'd like to learn more about him and his work, you can go to his website, which is samquiñones.com. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just real quick here, and I have somebody else who's I want to get to. The question of drug legalization has apparently come up recently in Mexico. I think last month, the president, Felipe Calderon, said that there should at least be a debate on the subject. Yeah. The former president, Vicente Fox, said that would be a good idea. And apparently there are other people who have said, well, at the very least, maybe we should be thinking about legalizing marijuana, if not the other sorts of things. And this kind of connects to the fact that, as I understand it, in the fall in the state of California, there's going to be a vote on legalization of marijuana in California, which it could be interesting if, you know, something like that worked out for between the two countries. Are people in Mexico seriously talking about this?
I think it's come up. I'm not sure how serious you can take that. I mean, I'd like to see the debate proceed before I'd say that, oh, yeah, people are really serious. There's a lot of, and the war and the bloodshed make it kind of a crucial issue. But yes, the president said he'd want to debate about it. He said he was personally against that idea, but he'd want to debate on it. Mexico City has legalized small amounts of drugs for possession. You know, small, you know, the kind that you would for personal use only kind of amounts. But the key question, though, frankly, is not whether Mexico legalizes drugs, but whether the United States does, because that's where the market is. I mean, the market is growing in Mexico, but it's not. It pales in comparison to the U.S. drug market.
Yeah, and I have an email from someone who was listening to the conversation and said, for example, he apparently heard someone who worked as an administrator for the DEA say that if marijuana was legalized, apparently the cartels would just move the other things that they can move, the more dangerous drugs, cocaine, heroin, whatever. So that wouldn't necessarily put them out of business.
I mean, I don't know what the cartels would do. It's possible. But, I mean, they're already doing those moving those drugs. I just think that the demand for marijuana has always been more steady and more vast than the demand for methamphetamine, for example. The profit margins may be greater, and it may be the other drugs are easier to traffic. I mean, in order to bring in a lot of marijuana, you have to have a big truck or something, you know, a very large space, because it's a bulky drug. Unlike heroin, which is basically a softball of heroin, worth of heroin will be significant amount of dope. What the cartels end up doing I don't know. They may end up trying to push more of their other drugs, but I'm not sure that there is that they can count on the kind of demand and the kind of year in year out demand for that they can count on with marijuana. There simply is. I don't believe that the demand for cocaine is simply not the same as the demand for marijuana, even in the worst of times. So.
Well, let's take another caller here. Someone up in the northern part of the state in Elgin. They're on our line one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting show. I've got a question, kind of a double-layered question. It involves subcultures in Mexico, I think. When I was growing up in the south side of Chicago in Aurora, there was a local family that was involved in marijuana and heroin sales. And the Mexicans that I knew, Mexican-Americans I knew, claimed that the people involved in these kind of trade were generally Indios, or what they call Indios, whatever that adjective signified. And I was wondering if there are groups in Mexico that are ethnically identifiable, or states where it's more prevalent, for example, to be involved in these kind of illegal activities, much like, for example, the mafia is in Italy, associated with Sicily. There could be nothing more unusual than having a mafia underground in a state like Lombardy or Tuscany, much like it would be strange to have the KKK in Vermont. So I'm not sure I'm getting myself across, but are there ethnic groups that are more clearly more identified with illegal drug trafficking or subcultures in Mexico? Because, of course, I'm not sure there is a Mexico. There are many Mexicos from my experiences as a tourist only. I saw so many different Mexicos.
Right. Yes, you know, that is a, that's a terrific question. I would say the opposite is true. What your friends told you was not true. Indio normally means Indian. I'm not aware of very many Mexican Indians trafficking drugs at all. On the contrary, quite the contrary, the main groups that are trafficking drugs to the United States are Northern Mexicans. And principally, the history of drug trafficking in Mexico is fascinating because it all, as you point out, with the mafia in Sicily, and in fact, the mafia not just in Sicily, but a few towns in Sicily. I was reading Honor Thy Father, Gay Talese's book about the Bonanno family out of New York, and how I was surprised to learn that so much of the mafia that we know as the mafia in the United States came from one town, Castellammare in Sicily. That is also true in Mexico. The name of the town that has really created all of this, and now it's of course spread, but the place where it all started, really you can pinpoint it. It's a town called Badiraguato. That's Badiraguato in the state of Sinaloa. That is where all the main traffickers came from, and a whole lot of others that you haven't heard of. And in fact, in the state of Sinaloa is the state where it all starts. Sinaloa is a Pacific Coast state. If you look on the map of Mexico, it's very easy to find. It's where the best known town in Sinaloa is Mazatlan. It's a coastal state, very long. It's about, by car, it's about 7 hours, maybe 8-9 hours due south of Arizona. And that is where trafficking starts, and that is where trafficking spreads and becomes a kind of a culture. And there's great tunes, you know, to these guys, and there's songs about these guys, and they wheedle their way in over a period of like 30 years into society, and their money infects everything, and it is a state essentially very much attuned to the idea of free markets, as one of the free marketeering states of Mexico was Sinaloa. These folks are all tall and white, okay? Another thing Sinaloa is known for is its beauty queens. They're gorgeous, gorgeous women. Every time you go to Sinaloa, you're invited by the taxi cab drivers to admire how gorgeous their women are. And I'll give them that. They are very beautiful women down in Sinaloa. But they're all tall and white and very European looking folks. And Sinaloans are really known. All you have to say is a Sinaloa was killed and found dead in a ravine, and everyone knows. It's a trafficker. It's a culture of drug trafficking that is very, very deep in that state. And when you get into it, you find that it's not always just even certain the whole state, but it's certain counties of Sinaloa. For example, Badiraguato, which is also a county, is a big one, huge one. Then there's also Sinaloa de Leyva, Leyva is another county. There's Mochis, there's Fuerte. These are different counties where everyone is involved in some way in drug trafficking. An interesting point in all that, I was out at a prison in Oklahoma talking with a trafficker, guys who had been arrested in Arizona, as a matter of fact, and where there's a lot of folks from Sinaloa. Now, Phoenix, you may have read, has a horrible problem with kidnapping. Ransom kidnapping is really an extinct crime in most of the United States, but in Phoenix, it's huge because there's a lot of traffickers there, and they go about kidnapping each other for money or dope or what have you. Well, this guy was telling me he was arrested in Phoenix for that and for a variety of other crimes, but he was telling me that his entire village the men come here to Phoenix to kidnap. That's what their town, that's the town trade, kind of. You know, everyone learns a trade talking with each other around the plaza. You know, there's not a lot of education. You learn what you can from people who are nearest to you. Well, kidnapping is what these guys do. So this whole town, 90% of the men have come to the United States, principally Phoenix, to be kidnappers. And then, of course, they begin to freelance into other things, and they take pirates, you know, they take down loads of dope or loads of immigrants and what have you. They do a lot of different things, but it's primarily kidnapping that they come to do. So anyway, in answer to your question, I would say read about the state of Sinaloa. It is the state where all this has flowered from. Now, of course, there are other states now doing it because the money is so great and people can see it, but Sinaloa is where it all started.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comment of the call. I want to go back for a second to Mexican politics and the story that you told earlier, which is actually one that I have also read, although I don't think we get this analysis very much, and that is the connection between the fall from power of the longtime ruling Mexican party, and the increase in violence. Going back to, as you said, this idea that the PRI had really regulated the trade,
yeah,
and that when the PRI lost the presidency, of course, that's been 10 years, but when the PRI lost the presidency and really began to lose a lot of its control, then no one was in control. And so now that raises a question about, it's another 2 years, but we will have another presidential election in 2012. Right. It's a term limited thing, so you get to have one term, and the PAN has been held the presidency now since Vicente Fox was elected in 2000. So, but this all, you wonder, well, is this increase in violence actually good for the PRI? And can PRI candidates argue that they would be better able to deal with this and use that as an argument to try to get people to vote for them?
It's possible. I'd say a couple of things. Yes, it's possible. Who knows what the next 2 years will bring? I certainly don't. But that's possible. One thing I would say, though, is that a lot of Mexicans may remember what life was during the PRI, and it was the Mexico, the kind of a shoddy Mexico, you know, kind of a corrupt and venal place that people may not want to return to. On the other hand, the violence is such that they may in fact yearn for those days. It's a hard call to make right now. I think another year or two, another year or so, and you'll have a clearer idea of how the people are going. I would say, though, if there's a lot more of these successes that the government can point to, like we took down this guy, we took down that guy. I think that, for example, the Tijuana example is a very good one. That was a fearsome cartel, and now it's in shambles, really, because of the arrest of a few key people. And I think personalities do matter. So if they can continue with some of these major coups against these capos who are so so charismatic a lot of times, that they can that will begin to show people that, you know, do you really want to go back to the party that that got us here, essentially, that created this whole thing. I would say also, though, that should the PRI win, it would not be the same PRI that ran Mexico. I say that because the PRI that ran Mexico had control of everything, every mayor's office, every state house, the legislature, the Supreme Court, the electoral board, the National Electoral Board. All of that was in control of one party, which is why it could become so corrupting and all. That is not the case anymore. There is not that same Mexico where you have people who, you know, where you have vast institutions controlled by one party. There's a lot of pluralism. There's a lot of very kind of rambunctious actors on the political stage that do not allow it themselves to be controlled in this way. So it's not the same PRI that would take over Mexico if it won in 2012. Also, there is a faction of the PRI that is very concerned, I think, about how the country is viewed for foreign investment and this kind of thing. And if it's viewed as a country in bed with traffickers, you know, that's just not a good thing. So I don't know. But I mean, I'm very bad at predicting the future. So let me just say time will tell.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus is the journalist, author Sam Quiñones, who works for the L.A. Times, has written a lot about Mexico, has authored two nonfiction books, and we're talking here about contemporary Mexico and its politics and drug violence, and the questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk. At illinois.edu. Talked a little bit earlier about this recent event that certainly got the attention of a lot of people. That is last month when it was discovered that there was a mass grave with 72 people in it, migrants who apparently had come from Central and South America. They were blindfolded and they were shot and they were put in a mass grave. And this happened in Tamaulipas. And it seemed that there were a lot of questions about this. And maybe one of the biggest questions was, well, why? What exactly was this about?
That's a terrific question. I don't know that anyone knows the answer to why exactly these guys were killed. I can tell you this, though, that there is has been, particularly on the part of a group called Los Zetas, the Zetas, meaning Zetas means Z, and it's really a group of former Mexican special operations military soldiers who broke off, deserted, and became protective bodyguards for the Gulf cartel leaders, and now they're essentially their own cartel. They've broken away from the Gulf cartel. In fact, they're warring with the Gulf cartel. That's why Tamaulipas is a particularly dangerous spot right about now, and Monterrey as well. But basically, those guys have not viewed drugs as the only thing they do. Unlike the Sinaloans. The Sinaloans are pretty much, they're about drugs. There's some other minor things that they get into illegally and stuff, but it's really about smuggling dope into the United States for them. The Zetas have always been, and I think this has to do with the culture of where they are. It's a very interesting thing. The Sinaloans took over the entire border, with exception of the last 500 miles from along the Texas border to the Gulf of Mexico. The Sinaloans were drug traffickers, hillbillies, yahoos, guys firing weapons in the air at a party and that kind of stuff. They came from the mountains, and they were not terribly lettered guys. The culture along the southern, along the last 500 miles or so of the Rio Grande down to the Gulf of Mexico is very different. That's the only part of the border that was not taken over by Sinaloans. It was instead taken over by guys who were already smugglers, dating to a long time back. So I think it's as far back as Prohibition. But then also they were the ones who were smuggling stuff into Mexico back when Mexico had high tariffs on perfume, on all kinds of consumer goods, perfumes, sneakers, stereos, TVs, all this kind of stuff. There was nevertheless, because of the corruption of the priest system, a huge amount of illegal sale of all these kind of this merchandise. In fact, you would very openly take, you know, and controlled by the politicians and the political class, so very openly the entire neighborhood, which I wrote about in my first book, True Tales from Another Mexico. There's the neighborhood of Tepito of Mexico City was awash. You just couldn't. It was everywhere. All these illegal goods were there. The guys who controlled that smuggling were the ones who later became dope smugglers in the 70s and 80s. Increasingly became dope smugglers. They went from merchandise to smuggling dope into the United States. The skills were set was the same. The routes were pretty much the same. So the transference of from merchandise to dope wasn't that hard, but they remain kind of city-fied guys who are looking for their opportunity, and it doesn't matter where it comes, drugs, whatever, doesn't matter. Well, they have seen the great, you know, business opportunity in kidnapping immigrants. That's a new thing in the last, I'd say, 2 years, something like that, where they have figured out, hey, these guys are worth more money than you know. They're paying their coyote back in Ecuador or back in Oaxaca or someplace like that, or maybe even Brazil. But we have the guns. We can just take them hostage and demand more money from them. And they've been doing this across Mexico. So it's kind of like that business mindset that was created over the last 60 years or what have you by smuggling merchandise has now kind of been transplanted to the drug world, and they figure we got all the guns, we got the control, we got the routes into the United States controlled. These guys are going to pay us a bunch of money now. So that has been a business opportunity for parts of the Gulf cartel, and primarily the Zetas, for a couple 3 years I've been hearing about anyway. Why these folks were killed, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't make any sense because you would think that these guys would have, they're worth money to these guys. Something must have happened, but I can't tell you why. But the background is that these traffickers in dope are now traffickers in humans, and they're also not just traffickers in humans, they're also kidnappers. And they don't have any qualms about saying, I don't care who you paid before me, but your family's going to come up with another $2,500 or you're not going to make it across the border. That's very common nowadays.
We've got about five, 6 minutes left. Let me ask you a different sort of question. You talked a little bit earlier about the problem for Felipe Calderon in dealing with the cartels is that in Mexico, on the regional and local level, they just don't have honest, competent police force that they can deal with. So his only alternative was to use the Mexican army. And I think so that the solution here has his solution, maybe it was the only thing he could do, primarily was a military one. I think some people have said, or at least asked the question, is there some other way, is there something else that the government could be doing, perhaps in trying to improve the lives of people or work on the Mexican economy or give people alternatives that would help, some alternative to this to just sending in the army?
Right. I mean, these are huge questions you're bringing up. First, about the local idea. You know, I was talking with an economist the other a while back, and he was saying, these guys are simply Tony Soprano. You know, that's who these guys are. They are not they're not Al Qaeda. They're not, you know, some terrorist group. They are Tony Soprano. Now, you know, in the United States, Tony Soprano and his like have been dealt with for decades by local crime commissions, local task forces, local cops, all that kind of stuff. In Mexico, however, Tony Soprano has risen to the level of national threat, existential threat almost at times, and at least for certain regions, it's certainly that way. And that is really because there is no local law enforcement. There is no there are none of these task forces. There is no culture of excellence in the police departments, where police have a real feeling for who they are, and they take it very seriously, and they're well paid, and they know the pension will be there for their folks if they're killed, and on and on and on like that. There's a whole bunch of things. The prisons are awful. The court system's awful. So in my view, it's always been about, and I've written about this, I was writing about this for a long time when I was down in Mexico, reforming Mexican local government has got to be one of the first things that people do. It's also important, and they're not doing it right now, but they should be. It's also very important to the eventual economic development of Mexico. You cannot reform, you cannot develop economically if your local government is in tatters, and that's the way most local governments are in Mexico. They're in tatters. You cannot plan for your own local. You cannot plan for your own local economic development. You cannot build your roadways or plan for housing over here. On the contrary, this stuff just kind of happens haphazardly and without much planning in most cities anyway, in most regions, most counties. And so until I was kind of hoping that this whole tragedy that's befallen Mexico in the last 5 years or so, 6 years, would really motivate the Mexican political elite to begin looking at some of these issues and begin to start pushing them. There's an inertia, however, in Mexico that is very, very hard to defeat, and so far they have not. They've done some things, but they haven't done a lot.
Felipe Calderon, I think, and maybe others have said this too, have talked about the drug cartels as being a threat to Mexico, to the country, to the federal government.
Of course, yeah.
Is that true?
They're a threat to almost everything you can name. You know, I mean, they're in many parts of the country. Now, there's a lot of parts of the country where they just aren't a factor at all, or they're just not violent. But, you know, business development, the environment. I mean, these guys, when they cook their methamphetamine, just destroy the environment. I mean, there's a long list of things about how these guys are just bad. They're a cancer, and that's why a lot of people, I believe, do not feel that there was more anything Felipe Calderon could do except what he did. You cannot just sit back and say, "Oh, that's okay. Maybe we'll ignore them and they'll shut down." Or let's cut another deal with them, as we've done for the last 40 years or what have you. That just wasn't going to work. It's a cancer; it has to be dealt with. And while I don't feel that that, you know, Mexico is not Somalia or Afghanistan. Let's make that extremely clear. That's not even close to being the case. It is nevertheless a danger and something that the Mexican government and people have to deal with. And frankly, of course, the U.S. government and people have to understand their own involvement in what's going on down there and the importance to actions here in combating all that.
Well, that's, and unfortunately we have about a minute left, but what can the United States government do to help, do you think?
I think there's always more cooperation. The two countries have spent the entire last century distanced. They're united by a border, and they know nothing about one another. You talk to most people in Congress in both countries, they don't know a thing about Mexico. They don't know a thing about the United States. There's almost no, except for on the law enforcement end, which is where you're seeing a lot of very interesting cooperation, a lot of kind of, that's where the diplomacy is kind of happening, if you ask me. More cooperation than was the case before, not as much as needs to be done, but more. I mean, that kind of stuff, it always leads to better conversations, more productive actions, and this kind of thing. I really do believe, and I think the Obama administration started out this way and kind of has dropped off on a little bit in this, but I really believe that working closely with Mexico, inviting them here, going down there constantly, I mean constantly, there's no reason why this should not happen, given that we have this long, conflicted border between us. This kind of thing will lead in the end to the discovery of solutions that may not be apparent now, I think. That's kind of my optimistic, cheery point of view. Sometimes I'm not quite so optimistic. But, I mean, if I had one thing to say, that would be more cooperation between these countries, relentless, consistent, going across administrations. That is what brings these two countries, and together they can most definitely defeat this. This is not something I don't believe that can't be defeated by these two countries together.
All right. Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Sam Quinones, is a journalist. He's author. He works for the Los Angeles Times. He's authored two nonfiction books about Mexico. Those are True Tales from Another Mexico and Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration. If you'd like to learn more about him, you can look at his website, which is samquinones.com. And Sam, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on.